Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I'm your host. This is MJ Network, and this is going to be really exciting. We have the author of Dark Tomorrow here. We're going to talk about the dark web, and research is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Fran. Great to talk to you again.
Yes, it's nice to have you here. So this book was really exciting. Let's tell everybody a little character, Lisa, on how you created her.
Well, FBI Special Agent Lisa Tanchik is the protagonist in Dark Tomorrow and also my previous book, Black Nowhere. And she is a special agent who investigates cyber crimes. And so she has a very particular skill set. And, I based her on, real investigators in the FBI. And she's not your traditional FBI agent. She's more of a computer geek than sort of a gun-toting field operative. But in Dark Tomorrow, she's pursuing a hacker who ultimately is involved in a larger cyber attack on the U.S.
Well, she's the FBI, so why is she called CyberCom?
Well, so much of criminal activity is now conducted online that the FBI has recognized that it's an important part of crime fighting to have investigators with those cyber skills. And so they have special units within the FBI that specialize in that sort of enforcement.
So she's got a relationship with this guy, John. How come it seems strained at this particular point?
Well, she met John when she was working in San Francisco, which the first book was set in the San Francisco FBI field office. And now she's followed him to a teaching job at Quantico in D.C. And their relationship is a little bit rocky in this book, in
mm-hmm.
part because Lisa has some ongoing issues with depression, and she deals with that by abusing alcohol in some cases. So she's a little bit of a troubled person, but she manages to be pretty high functioning at work nonetheless, and she's a talented investigator.
Yes, she is. You don't want to mess with this one. So going to CyberCom, she meets Olaf. What is their role? And tell us about the person she's been after. She's dancing with somebody kind of dangerous there.
Right. She's been pursuing this hacker for about a
mm-hmm.
year when the book opens. And she's known as Natalia X. And
mm-hmm.
her MO is sending these emails with attachments that are designed to induce an epileptic seizure in people who are vulnerable
mm-hmm.
to that sort of strobe. So what that email would do is you would receive a spoofed email, something that you would want to answer or click on, and when you click on the attachment, a powerful strobe would be set off, so it would be flashing in your face. And if you have epilepsy, that sort of strobe can trigger an epileptic seizure, which in the worst cases can be fatal. And that's what happens to the victim in Chapter 1 of Dark Tomorrow. Lisa's called to a crime scene in Maryland where, a man has been killed by opening one of those attachments.
That's scary. makes you not want to open up any attachments, let me tell you. So the dark web is very much a part of this book. How does someone access it, and why do they access it? Because it's dangerous. They have to have a reason to want to do that.
That's right. It is a dangerous dark place, and the dark web is basically a sea of unindexed websites. They're not the websites that we typically access when we go on Google or Safari, and basically you need a special web browser called Tor or the Onion Router to access the dark web. And yes, quite a few people do it. They usually do it because they want to remain anonymous, because it's possible to do certain things without without revealing your identity through the use of encryption on the dark web. So there's a lot of criminal activity that happens there. But also sometimes it's political dissidents can communicate there, maybe out of the reach of an authoritarian state. But mostly I think it's criminal activity.
That's scary. So Lisa goes to CyberCom and they don't want her there. How come? She doesn't feel very welcome.
Right. Well, she's been pursuing this hacker, Natalia X, for a year. And when she comes to this crime scene in Maryland in Chapter 1, she thinks it's just, it's a very serious event because a death has resulted, but that it's more of a criminal matter for the FBI. But it becomes apparent fairly quickly that this is more than just, a murder by a hacker. It's really the beginnings of a comprehensive attack on the East Coast of the United States, a cyber warfare attack that's going to shut down the power grid, transportation, internet. It's just this enormous attack. And the person who was the victim in Chapter 1 was a worker, an analyst at U.S. Cyber Command, which is the agency that defends the nation against cyber threats. So it becomes apparent that this was just the first, part of the first wave of this attack. And so to the extent that Lisa knows who that attacker was, the government believes she may have the ability to help identify who's behind the larger attack. So that means that she gets read into the ongoing response to the cyber attack, which takes her into a whole new world. Instead of working within the FBI, now she's in Fort Meade, Maryland, at the headquarters of U.S. Cyber Command and the NSA, working with the top government defense people. So it's
That's
a new world
scary.
For her. She's a little bit of a fish out of water. And some people welcome her assistance, and some people think that she's an interloper and not welcome.
Well, that's with anything. But, boy, what would happen if this could really happen, I guess? I mean,
it really could.
Shut down the whole world? It could, yeah. It scared me. I said, oh, my God, it really could happen.
Right. I did a lot of research into cyber warfare, while I was working on this book. And one thing that I came to appreciate is that cyber warfare attacks happen every day. There's all this skirmishing between countries. It hasn't accelerated to a full-scale war yet, except in certain instances, like between the Soviet Union and Georgia and Russia and Ukraine. There are some cases where there's been real real cyber warfare activity, but it happens all the time. It's just the worst case scenario hasn't transpired yet, and that's what I wrote in Dark Tomorrow, what I thought would be the worst case scenario.
I just hope that they're watching and paying attention. Everybody is so caught up in this horrific virus that I just hope that they're watching other things too besides that. This horrible thing.
Right. Yeah. Some people who've read Dark Tomorrow said it sort of resonated for them in this time of COVID-19, because
yeah.
even though it doesn't deal with a pandemic, it deals with a situation where the country is shut down and people are feeling a lot of uncertainty and they're not able to rely on a lot of the things that they ordinarily rely on in their daily life. And so maybe it was timely in that sense.
It was. It really was. And I did a broadcast yesterday with two healthcare workers and a police detective. And we talked about social distancing and how serious this is and wearing a mask. And I was wearing a mask last Sunday, and I had an accident because I was wearing the mask. My glasses got fogged up, and I fell and broke my thumb.
Oh, no.
And
I hope you're okay.
Yeah, I did. I broke my thumb in two places. I hurt my knee, I hurt my other knee, and I hurt my elbow, but a bump on my brain, and what can I say? And it was the fault of wearing the mask, because I was walking, and two people were walking by me, so I let them pass. And my glasses fogged up, so I didn't see whatever it was on the sidewalk that was dented, so oh well. But they came back to help me up, because I said, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And yeah, what can you do? So,
sometimes it brings out some good things in people too. So at least they stopped and helped you out, and
And then the emergency team helped me out even more. That was a joy. I called them and said I'm coming, and they just said we know. But tell us about the general, and who else does she deal with in this particular case? Who else does she have to work with? This general isn't crazy about her either.
Yeah, there's one person that she works closely with. He's a Ukrainian security consultant named Arkady Orlov. And she's partnered with him at Cyber Command because Orlov, has been on the front lines and experiencing what Russia has been doing to Ukraine in recent years. Which has involved basically tormenting them in every way possible through cyber attacks. And in the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, Russia has been practicing a lot of its cyber warfare tactics. And, that's why he's a very knowledgeable person who basically understands the enemy that they think they're dealing with. And Lisa isn't used to working with such a opinionated, difficult partner as Arkady is, but they ultimately become friends and become an interesting pair.
Yeah, they do. So it's hard. How do they counteract this? And what made them think it was the Russians? And tell us about the GRU. Why did they think it was them that did this?
Well, there are a number of clues that lead them to thinking that there's Russian and GRU involvement. Some of it is the nature of the malware that's used. In one case, they figure out that some of the malware that was used to shut down an electrical power plant in New Jersey, was created by someone using a Cyrillic keyboard. So that's one indicator. Another is that this hacker, Natalia X, has certain connections to Russia. So those sorts of connections are things that, turn up in real cyber investigations. So slowly they piece together, that they strongly suspect that Russia is basically waging war on the U.S., but they can't quite prove it. And that's where, Lisa Tanchik comes into the picture. And that's one of the challenges of cyber warfare, because in traditional warfare, someone sends an army or launches missiles, and it's very clear who the attacker is. But in a cyber warfare scenario, you can do a great deal of damage and still not necessarily leave a trail to indicate who the attacker is. And that's why this is also troubling, that while the East Coast of the United States is shut down and all these catastrophic outcomes are resulting, the president and U.S. Cyber Command still can't quite put their finger on who's behind it. And that's why Lisa's mission is so critical here, because in order to strike back, they need to know who the enemy is.
That's scary. So who is Emma Glass? And she hates Lisa, too.
Yes, Emma Glass is a former colleague of Lisa's. They went to school together, and there's they were students in a program called CyberCore, which is a real program where talented cybersecurity experts get scholarships if they agree to devote their skills to the federal government once they're out of school. And so Lisa and Emma were two top students in that CyberCore program and competitors. And now, many years later, they meet up again because Emma is working as one of the primary people at Cyber Command. And so she comes under, Lisa works with her in pursuing this investigation. But there's still a little bit of the old rivalry there. They try to put it behind them, but they're not the best of friends.
I could see why. So things spiral out of control, and she's sent with Orloff after Natalia X. But does Natalia X know that she's after her?
Yes. Natalia X, is very, cyber savvy, and she's well aware, at a certain point that Lisa Tanchik is her pursuer, and the cat and mouse game begins, and Natalia places certain traps for Lisa, and vice versa. So the throughout the book, it's pretty much a cat and mouse game as Natalia X continues to carry out her mission of sort of facilitating this cyber attack in the U.S. and Lisa is trying to track her down before the worst damage can be done, because there's a new phase to the attack that's going to happen, and they have clues to indicate it's going to happen at a certain time. So Lisa has to catch Natalia X before that happens.
Before somebody else picks up an attachment. Whoa, really? So
right.
She finds where she thinks she is, but why is she so elusive? Because she doesn't find her right away. She can't find her.
Right. Well, she's adopted, a false identity, and, I think that she's a very elusive enemy who, adopts a variety of identities online. And that's something that, as we saw in the first book in the series, Black Nowhere, Lisa is very adept at taking on different personas online. And Natalia X, it turns out, does the same thing, and she does it very well, which makes her a very worthy adversary, because, she's every bit as talented in the cyber realm as Lisa is. So they sort of chase each other both in the real world and in the online world.
Well, Lisa does what some other people do. When things get too tough, she drinks. So that is not good. So how does John deal with her mood swings, and how does it affect her work? Because she comes in bombed, that's not good.
Right. She, particularly in times of crisis, and there are some definite times of crisis that she encounters during this book, she does treat her depression with alcohol, which creates tensions in her relationship with John. And, those tensions are exacerbated because, Lisa has a job where she, carries a gun and engages in some very dangerous activities. And so he's concerned that, because he's also an FBI agent, that if he remains silent about her problem, it could ultimately endanger Lisa in the field, or jeopardize his career if it comes to light that he knew about her issues and didn't disclose them to their superiors. So, you know, it's, and Lisa believes that she, you know, while she has definite issues, she believes that she's handling it and is able to function effectively out in the field. John is not so sure about that, and so that's a real source of tension for them.
Well, that is bad in any way, yeah. So he has sort of like between a rock and a hard place, because if he keeps quiet and something happens, it's his fault, and if he doesn't, tells he's going to lose her. I don't want to be in that position. That's very bad.
Right. Things sort of come to a head in their relationship during this book. And when it starts out in book one, we see them sort of first meet, where he's, you know, in basically asking her out on a date, and she's busy with her investigation. But we see the beginnings of the relationship in book one, and now it's now they're living together in D.C. and both teaching at Quantico.
That makes it hard. So the part that I found interesting was, how did you create the text between her and Natalia X? And does Natalia X know it's Lisa?
In most cases, you know, Natalia X knows that she's dealing with Lisa, but I don't want to give away too many spoilers here, but you know, sometimes Lisa doesn't know that she's dealing with Natalia. So but that's all I'm going to say about that.
That's scary. That is scary. You have to be careful when you go on the net, let me tell you.
That's true, and that's something I play around with in my books, because, you know, it's it does provide a lot of opportunities for misdirection as a thriller writer, because when you're dealing in a world where no one really knows who's on the other side of the screen or the keyboard, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for deception.
Well, the scary part is, and I've gotten spoof mail, I know that when I get an email from somebody that sends me normal emails, but it's a link, I delete it. I automatically delete it. I don't open up anything like that. So how did they create spoof mail? And why was Orloff fooled? He's a smart guy, but oh boy.
Right. Well, it's a very common tactic to create spoofing emails that look like something that you're familiar with or that you would click on. And, you know, that's something that we all, like you say, we deal with that every day. You know, even at my law firm, you know, I'm an attorney when I'm not writing thrillers. Our IT department, you know, has trained us to spot, you know, spoof emails. And occasionally the IT department sends us some, you know, to see if we click on them or not. And if we click on them, we get a message that we need to be more careful. And they teach us the warning signs, you know, to look for when the the email address of the sender is just a little bit off. There's, you know, it always pays to, you know, to look at the address of the sender, because, you know, usually it's not that hard to spot, you know, a spoofed email if you're watching for it. And, you
well,
know, that's,
I had my email hacked recently too, and I was getting jobs from foreign countries out of nowhere. Must have gotten about 30 or 40 of them, and my husband had to sit down. He's into computers and stuff. He worked for IT, and he went and, you know, he blocked everything. It's scary. I mean, it was coming from all over the place, and they were offering me, I couldn't even understand what the heck, whether it was from Russia, some of them were from Japan, they were all over the place. It's scary. So
definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very real threat, and it's even more of a threat when the hackers are sophisticated, because you know, if it's somebody that is sending 1,000 emails out, and they haven't taken a lot of trouble to deceive you. Usually, they're just hoping to play the odds that they'll get some people who will be careless and will click. But the most insidious ones are ones where the attacker has learned a little bit about you, and they know what you're interested in, and they know what will look innocuous to you, and that's a really hard to defend against when somebody kind of knows what you are likely to click on.
Well, it's scary because on LinkedIn, I get a lot of requests. Everybody wants to be in my network, and I'm very careful. if they're from certain countries, I just automatically say ignore. And especially if there's only one mutual whatever, and if it's a young student or something, I know that they want money. So I'm really careful. I don't deal with that. You have to be really careful when you're clicking on something like that. Even on Facebook, if the person isn't an author, and I don't know if they don't know anybody that I know, if it's only one whatever, I ignore it too. I don't deal with that. So there's a mole in CyberCom. So how does she figure that out? And without telling who it is, whatever, how does she get in to go to see the president right away? Because she gets an audience.
Right, right. It's because the attack is so, insidious, and because the attackers seem to always be one step ahead of Cyber Command, mm-hmm. it eventually dawns on Lisa that there must be a mole, inside Cyber Command, and she can tell that by some of the information that Natalia X seems to have access to. It's the kind of information that only someone inside the agency would know. And so that leads her to concoct a strategy of basically hacking back against the GRU to try to figure out, to get inside their systems and to figure out who the mole is. And
that's scary.
Don't want to say too much.
Yeah, but now
much,
they go after something else, which is even more scary. They realize she learned about the water purification plants as targets. How do you stop that? That's scary. I mean, just a water supply? Oh, my God.
Right, right. And I think that one of the primary threats against the U.S., certainly, there are targets like public transportation and the power grid, but there are also chemical and industrial plants that through hacking could be turned into weapons or bombs, essentially. And one of them, would be these, water filtration plants, which contain gases that can be, toxic if released. And so that's a threat that is dealt with later in the book.
Well, it's funny because, not funny, but I don't drink tap water ever. For some reason,
I'm sorry, Fran, I can't hear you very well. You sort of faded out there.
I only drink bottled water. I won't drink tap water ever. I won't even take an aspirin with the water from the sink. If I use it to make coffee, it's got to be, because it's going to be hot. And they have said many times that even using water from the sink can get you sick. I don't know why, but it does at times.
Right, right. And in this, the attack that I look at, it's not, they certainly could target the water supply, but in fact what they're trying to do is turn those water filtration plants into bombs, into weapons, basically, by causing them to release toxic gases.
That's always fun. So who are the other members of CyberCom and the FBI? And they don't want to deal with her either.
Right. There's, certainly in some quarters, she's, welcomed for her expertise at Cyber Command. But, there's also a, somebody who definitely feels that she doesn't belong on the team, shouldn't have the access to, certainly to the White House that ultimately, occurs in this book. And so, she definitely has a number of people who are suspicious of her and don't want her involved. And, I think that kind of interagency sniping is something that, probably is not uncommon in the real world.
Well, if you listen to the task force versus the governors, there is definitely a difference. That's for sure.
Right. And in the first book, Black Nowhere, we also had some of that interagency politics because there Lisa was part of a task force It was trying to bring down a dark web marketplace. And so there we saw competition among, you know, the different law enforcement agencies to, you know, to be the one to bring home the investigation.
Well, maybe our law enforcement agencies will figure out a way to stop that miserable virus from killing so many people and do it the right way. Hopefully.
I hope so. Right.
It's scary, let me tell you. I mean, going outside every single day with a mask, I feel like I'm hidden behind my something and nobody knows who you are, which is more like the cyber world. Like, okay, everybody's hiding behind something and nobody knows who you are. So tell us why she's on the alert so often and what happens when she and Natalia X are in the same room.
Well, the chase, you know, finally, you know, leads to a confrontation toward the end of the book, and it's set in, you know, Washington D.C. during the heart of this attack when this second wave is about to be launched, and it culminates in the Smithsonian's American History Museum, which is abandoned and closed down. But I thought that would be an interesting place to set something. And so I'll just say a mock-up of Julia Child's kitchen features prominently in the one of the final scenes.
I wouldn't even know what to do in a kitchen. My husband cooks. I don't deal with that. Not even close. It's much better. I noticed also, because I have the book in front of me, you sort of did this in a timeline.
That's right. You know, it takes place over, you know, a pretty short span of time, and the chapters mark out the number of days, you know, between the first incident and the final attack. So it takes place over the course of about 10 days.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to do also, because each you know, day is another alert, or each day that happens, right? So she's on the alert so much, and yet what happens that she winds up in the hospital? That was like, Lisa, really?
Right, yeah. you know, even when you know, Lisa is injured and ends up in the hospital, you know, once again, no spoilers here, but that's not the end. That's not the end of the drama. You know,
no, it's
there's
not.
There's a final scene in the hospital that you know, hopefully will surprise the reader.
Well, every time she thinks that she's going to find Natalia X, she doesn't. How come she keeps getting away from her? I mean,
well,
she tries but she doesn't.
Yeah, I wanted Lisa to have a worthy adversary in this book, and here she's facing somebody who, you know, has a lot of the same skills that she has, and is very, very talented and adept at using all of the resources of the cyber world to both attack and to hide herself. And so, you know, that's sort of the course of the book. You know, that hunt for Natalia X. And, you know, hopefully, you know, keep the reader in suspense as that hunt ensues.
Well, I'm not going to tell you how the book ends, but whoa, what can I tell you? It's scary to think, yeah, that some. And Natalia X, is she working alone or by herself?
Well, she has a handler, and she's working, you know, under the supervision of the GRU. It's not too big of a spoiler to say that that's ultimately who's behind the attack is Russia and the GRU. But she's also, you know, left to her own devices to a large degree in the United States to develop her tactics and carry out her mission. So she's a lone operative, but she has support, you know, from the GRU.
Well, how does somebody like that infiltrate the United States, go to lunch, go to dinner, come all over the place, and nobody knows that she's there? How did they do that?
Well, it turns out that that the Natalia X identity actually does belong to someone who was a known, somewhat known sleeper agent of Russia and the U.S. And you know, just because the Cold War is over doesn't mean that you know, there aren't spies and counter spies in the U.S. and Russia. And a few years back, there was a high-profile incident where the U.S. expelled a number of Russian sleeper agents. And so sometimes, you know, our intelligence agencies apparently know that certain people, you know, are agents, but rather than kicking them out, they decide that they want to keep an eye on them and see what they can learn. And that was sort of the status of this character who is Natalia X. But then when the attack starts, she goes off the grid and disappears, and they lose track of her. And now they realize just what a threat she really is.
She's really a good villain. As a matter of fact,
thank
it's funny,
you.
On the 28th, I've got five people that are going to fight it out for who has the worst villain of all.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, the 14th on Thursday, I'm going to be interviewing Minister Sam Oliver. And we're going to talk about soul caring, healing care, and hospice care during the time of the coronavirus. On Tuesday, Pastor Michael Jones is going to talk about how we deal with stress and anxiety and uplift ourselves in a time of this virus. On the 21st, the King of Horror, Brian Moreland, Tomb of Gods. On the 26th, somebody we all know and love, John Land, Murder of 12. On the 28th, let's see if I can remember everybody, Tom Walsh, Charles Stolzberg, Bruce Coffin, Davin Goodwin, and R.G. Belsky are all going to join me, all five of them, to talk about how do you create your killer and how do you make them want to kill people and do you ever bring them back? That's one of my wild ideas. And it should be
that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's yeah. You should have no idea. I didn't. Well, what happened was there were originally four people, and then Davin was on the show the other day with Diver's Paradise. He says, "Aren't I on that one?" I go, "No, but you are now." So it should be interesting. Yeah, he is. Tom Walsh's character, his villains are deadly. So we'll see what Bruce and Charles and everybody else have to say. It should be interesting. So
sounds like a fun show.
Yeah, oh, please, you have no idea. And then in June, I'm doing another one about voice, point of view and voice, and how do you create voice? How does your character's voice come through? And that's something I have to learn how to do because I don't do dialogue because I don't want to be bothered with quotation marks. They get annoyed. They get in the way of me. So,
some writers do dialogue without quotation marks.
Yeah, I do. And they, as a reading and writing specialist, they probably would yell at me for doing that, but I do that a lot. I just write, and I don't even, after I'm done writing, I just send it to my editor and say, you read it, because I don't want to read it. When I'm done, that's it, I'm done. I don't want to know. So we pray to God that it sounds right. Okay, there are lots of lives that are at stake, and lots of broken and betrayals are this, but Lisa, at some times, her personality comes out where she seems to be only loyal to herself and her goals. How come? At one time, she seems like single-minded.
That's true. I mean, I think she's, you know, a person who, you know, is consumed by her work, you know, particularly when the stakes are high as they are in this book. I think she's willing to sacrifice a lot to accomplish her goals. I think in both book one and book two, you know, the stakes are pretty large because, in book one, she was driven in part by the fact that her sister had died of a drug overdose, and she was bringing down, you know, a drug marketplace on the dark web. And in this book, there's no doubt that the stakes are enormous because thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives are at stake if this terrorist attack succeeds. So, you know, she's obsessed, but I think it's not hard to understand why she's obsessed.
Well, that's why I wonder why she would drink, because she brought down this drug cartel, and she would want to not, I mean, I, deal with something that would, you know, hamper her brain from working. So it just doesn't, like, Lisa, really, the bottle is not, I don't drink ever. So my drink of choice is caffeine, coffee, that's it.
I love my coffee too, but rationally. You know, she should get healthy and stay off the stuff. But I think for people who have that issue, it's difficult to do, and particularly for people who suffer with depression, you know, it's a complicating factor in so many cases of alcohol abuse. And so for her, it's a way of coping.
Would she go to AA or rehab?
You know, she hasn't done that. She's a little resistant, but I think if she keeps going, I think she's going to need something like that at some point.
Well, how does the President of the United States, you know, this one is a lot more intelligent than a lot of other people, seriously. And, yeah. So how does the President of the United States deal with her, and how does he deal with this? Because he's not going to let it go like some people let the virus go.
Right. Yeah, no, we have a very, very competent president in this book who's a woman, President Maggie Bilton. And she deals with this crisis, I think, just the way you would want a president to deal with a crisis, which maybe was a little bit of wishful thinking on my part. But but she gets taken into the inner circle of the president's war room and war cabinet because she happens to turn up some key information that helps to determine who is attacking the U.S. with this cyber warfare attack. And that's information that the president and her team need because the president has the difficult decision of, you know, do I declare war on Russia? Do I have enough evidence to do that? And so that's why Lisa is at the center of some of those discussions, even though there are people on the team who resent her presence in the room.
Well, I would imagine they would, but this president doesn't go half, you know, she's not irrational. She thinks about things before she does it, right? She just doesn't go head on and say, okay, I'm going to declare war on Russia. I'm going to think about
right.
it first.
Right. I mean, that is, I think, if we ever see a full-scale cyber warfare attack, that's going to be the very sort of question that our president is going to have to grapple with. You know, at what point do you have sufficient evidence to treat cyber aggression as a true act of warfare? And also, they also have to deal with what's an appropriate response. You know, we have our own cyber weapons, and there are things that we can do, and we see the president and her team grappling with that. You know, what if you retaliate by, you know, throwing Russia and its power grid out, then, you know, innocent people in Russia are going to freeze to death in the winter, and you know, it'll have ramifications throughout the European Union as well because of trade between Russia and the EU. And so there's a whole series of dominoes that fall when you start making these kinds of geopolitical, you know, decisions. And so I tried to explore that a little bit too.
Well, the scary part is that the person at the top has to understand cyber warfare. They have to understand how to figure this out. They can't just turn around and say, well, this is what's going to happen and I'm going to attack Russia. They have to understand the mechanics of cyber warfare, how to use a computer, how to do hacking. And they have to have people that are actually intelligent enough to give intelligent, you know, advice, right? You can't just go off and say, yeah, I'm going to do this, I don't know. And then sometimes you wonder if the person that's at the head comprehends anything at all, which is scary.
That's right. And, you know, I think that, you know, the modern face of warfare is really cyber warfare. But it's still, you know, even though it's been around for a while now and we've seen examples, we haven't yet seen, you know, an example of, you know, sort of a large-scale cyber warfare incident. And so I think that even, even national defense leaders are still figuring out, you know, what this kind of warfare looks like and what the rules are. And so in the midst of this attack, everyone has to figure out those issues in a hurry and decide, you know, how they're going to respond.
How many agencies would be involved if, God forbid, something like that happened?
Well, a host of agencies, you know, both the, you know, the traditional, you know, military agencies, but also U.S. Cyber Command, you know, is kind of at the heart of cyber defense and offense. And then they're in the same building in Fort Meade, Maryland, as the National Security Agency, or NSA. And one thing I look at in the book is how, you know, those two agencies, even though they work together, they have slightly different missions. For example, Cyber Command is about defending the U.S. and really making sure that, that threats don't succeed. But the NSA is a little bit more interested in, you know, gathering intelligence. And that sort of issue was brought out in one of the early chapters in my book when there's some, you know, a deficiency, you know, a zero-day deficiency in a commonly used software program that everyone has on their computers. And that kind of widespread vulnerability is something that intelligence agencies like the NSA can use. They can exploit it to gain intelligence from our, you know, enemies who are using it. But the flip side is that that vulnerability exists for U.S. users of that program too. So there's a point at which, you know, they may know about a vulnerability in a program, and they may decide not to tell the maker that they found it, and it may not get corrected because they want to keep using it to gather intelligence. But if they wait too long, the enemy may discover that vulnerability and use it against us. So there's sort of competing, you know, missions there that leads to kind of a natural tension between U.S. Cyber Command and the NSA. One plays offense, another one plays defense.
I don't think enough people know that. I don't think enough people know that there is a U.S. Cyber Command either. That, I mean, that's really interesting. I don't think a lot of people know that there are so many different agencies involved in everything. What happens, though, if there's a mole in our agency and nobody knows it, and all of a sudden, I mean, like all those people did the attachment and that those people died for the epileptic attack. How do you deal with knowing that there's somebody there that's doing something? How do you find out who it is?
Well, yeah, you use those same cyber investigative techniques to try to track down, you know, the you know, the infiltrator. And, you know, in researching this book, I learned that there was a major security breach in you know, at the NSA and in our national security infrastructure a few years back. And it happened because through a very, you know, basically obvious technique, I think there was a U.S. military base, I believe it was in Turkey, where an infiltrator left flash drives in the parking lot. And this is kind of the oldest trick in the book for you know, cyber attackers. And someone picked up the flash drive at the military base, took it inside the compound and plugged it into their computer. And then that led to access to a host of, you know, top secret, very sensitive military secrets. And, you know, even though it's an old trick, you know, I use that device again in Dark Tomorrow. But this kind of vulnerability, it happens in the real world. You know, we have been exposed, and even just recently, I don't know about you know how, you know, truthful it is, or, you know, what the real story is yet. But there were reports just yesterday suspecting China of hacking our virus development, our vaccine development programs in the U.S.
Anything is possible with anything. And what scares me with this vaccine thing is that there are so many companies trying to play and get there so fast that when they get there, is it going to be something that's really going to work, or is it going to make people more sick? That's what's scary. Because the vaccine, I mean, I get nervous just taking the flu vaccine because everything has a side effect. And then they come up with this thing for hydrochloroquine. That was even worse.
Right,
so you don't
right.
know.
That's, that was wacky.
That is scary, I know. Because hydrochloroquine has sulfur in it. I looked it up just to see what it was made out of. And I'm allergic to sulfur. So what do you do if you can't take that? And that's not exactly the best medicine to take. It turned out not to be the right one. They don't even know
right.
what to do at this point.
Yeah, I think it's been demonstrated that is not the right thing to take. And hopefully there'll
yeah.
be a vaccine developed, but apparently that's far from certain. And you know, usually vaccine development can take years, apparently, and sometimes it's
yeah.
not even successful then. So fingers crossed that we get one.
Yeah, well, hopefully, because the flu vaccine is different every single year. I can't stand anything like that. So the ending lets us know that there's more to come for Lisa. What's next for Lisa?
Well, you know, actually, at the moment, I'm writing something a little bit different. It's a standalone thriller, and I would love to come back to Lisa, but the book that's next for me will not be a Lisa mm-hmm. Tanchik book. So maybe in a year or so when that's out, we can chat about that one, and I'll let you know
you will.
The new direction I've taken.
Well, according to the ending, which I won't tell, you would give have a thought that maybe there would be more Lisa. That's
yes,
why.
I definitely would love to do more Lisa books, and I definitely have left that possibility open. And I suppose you know, with the way the last chapter ends, you know, there
yeah,
could even
so
be a little partnering perhaps between Lisa and Natalia.
That would be interesting to see if they can actually work together. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I
so
don't know about that either.
Where can we learn more about you and your work?
Sure. Apart from, my author website is research.com, R-E-E-C-E-H-I-R-S-C-H.com. And apart from my writing work, I'm a lawyer, a privacy attorney. So I'm co-head mm-hmm. of the privacy and cybersecurity practice at an international law firm based in San Francisco.
That is interesting. That is very interesting. And I want to thank you so very much. For those of you that don't know it, I actually came up with a title for my new book, if I ever get it back from my editor. It's called What If? With a question mark. And it's not a Faces Behind the Stone. It's stories, more like stories like from the Twilight Zone. They're really out there. And I just wrote them out of nowhere. And I'm hoping that when I get it back, that I'm going to ask some people to read it to tell me where I went right and where I went wrong. But if you want to live in different kinds of worlds that you would not really want to live in, you're going to read What If. It's different. What would you do if you had to live in a world where you didn't have any choices to make and everybody had to look the same? And everybody had to do the same job every single day, but you had to look the same also. What if you can commit a crime and get away with it? Because crime pays if you can get away with it. That's just two of them. So you never know what I'm going to write. But this is interesting. Learning about cyber warfare, it's scary. And with what's going on, you know, in the news, it's even more scary. Because I don't think that they really understand the gravity of this virus. And I don't know about your state, but I know that we're lucky to have Cuomo. But I really
and
wish...
we're lucky to have Gavin Newsom. I think we've
got good
governors. We're lucky.
Yeah, there you are. I can't wait for him to open up my hairdresser so I could look normal again. Seriously.
I could use a haircut myself.
Well, you see, I have blonde hair. So yesterday, 2 days ago, I washed it with purple shampoo. It looks much better now. No, seriously, I have purple streaks. It's great. So I want to thank you so much. Thank you very, very much. And if I have another panel show where I need, I'm going to let you know so that you could join the team also. Everybody
please do. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for having me, Fran. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.